The following is a meeting with devotees with His Holiness Srila Das Goswami, recorded on August 15, 2001, in Innisfraith, Ireland.
So I'm going to speak on the Mahabharata. The film had some nice adaptations. It began, first thing you saw was a curly-haired teenage Indian fellow, and he was walking through the set. He didn't know what it was. It was a very big hall, Indian style, with mats and sheet. It was later to be the setting for the gambling match. And it was all ghee lamps all over the place, very big area. And he was like looking, what's this? And looking at all the different walls and places. Obviously unfamiliar to him, the whole thing. There's nobody there. He walked through it like that. And finally he came to one, and while he was doing that, all the credits were running down finally. Script written by so-and-so, Peter Brook, and directed by Peter Brook. Yesterday I was telling you how the casting was so wonderful. There was a book about how they produced it, and they went to India and they spent some time studying. Of course, the actual persons in the Mahabharata, they're so colorful and so wonderful and deep. If an actor could identify with those persons and try to project what they are, he's got a lot to go on. The wonderful character of Yudhisthira, for example, always true to religion. He doesn't act ever rashly, but always very thoughtfully considering all things. By comparison, Bhima, although he's a great fighter, he's always ready to act somewhat rashly. Yudhisthira considers everything according to religion. But I was telling about how the multi-race cast was all highly talented. It was very appealing to me. One devotee objected, almost sounded like a racist objection, that such great personalities as Bhisma and others should be come from Africa. But they shouldn't be like that if they're good in the part. For example, Mother Kunti, she was African too, and wow, she was just a great actor. And when every time she spoke, she had so much dramatic presence, suitable for the Great Mother. So this boy is wandering around, there's nobody there. And then finally, in one corner, kind of abruptly, he sees a sage seated in a half lotus position, kind of a scruffy looking sage with a beard and everything. It's Vyasadeva. And throughout the film, he appears like that. He comes on at different times. He has a very clean, well-dressed, but he speaks very wonderfully, beautifully. As I said, multi-race, so they all have these different accents, Italian accents, British accents were in preponderance. He had quite a good British accent. So the first words of the film were, he spoke to the young boy, who was a little startled. He said, "Can you write?" Which I like, because I'm a writer. You know, why should he ask? So the boy, he was not like a wallflower. He answered pertly right back, "No." He said, "Why do you ask?" And then Vyasa said, "Because I've written a beautiful poem, but I need someone to write it down." Well, what it turns out is this young boy, throughout the film, he appears like with Vyasadeva, and they're watching the action together. They're sort of outside of the play. The boy asks, "Well, why did that happen? What's going on here?" Vyasa is telling him. And sometimes Vyasa intrudes into the action. Pretty much the boy doesn't. And he's like a symbol of India, of what India is to become after the Mahabharata, or say, he's the receiver of the legacy of the great culture of the Mahabharata. And throughout the film, of course, you know, it's the elephant-headed Ganesh who actually writes it down. And they have a big book in which it's written down, and at the end the book is given to the young man. And he, again with that same slow and thoughtful way, he walks off the set, but now he has the history of his race, great story of the Mahabharata, which is not just the history of India, of course, the history of the whole human race and spiritual race, but it comes from a book. So, that was some of the film adaptation, which I wasn't in the mood to say, well, this isn't in the book, but it was quality to rivet your attention in the film, make it more accessible. He often asked questions that we might ask, you know, well, why are they behaving so cruelly? He asked when, what's the boy's name who had his thumb cut off? Ekalavya. He immediately turned to Vyasa and said, why is it such cruelty? And all these different questions he asked him. So let's hear again Prabhupada talking about how Dhritarashtra was supposed to take care of his brother's sons, the Pandavas, but he was more, as his brother died, and Dhritarashtra was more inclined to take care of his own sons. Not only more inclined to take care of them, but he was pushed by his evil son Duryodhana to kill the other boys and deny them their right to the kingdom. They were princes. So Prabhupada is speaking how Duryodhana and company tried in different ways to kill the Pandavas. And we first told the story of how he tried to kill them by poisoning them, poisoning Bhima in particular, Bhima. And then, when that didn't work, then he made a plan to burn them down in a holiday house. They kept talking about this wonderful place where there was a wonderful house they could go for vacation. And the boys kept hearing about it, and they said, well, it sounds so nice. Why don't we go there? He said, yes, you should go there with your mother. And you can have a wonderful time there. I think it's called Varnavarta. They went there. But they were warned that actually it was a plot. Who was their great friend within the palace who warned them of what was to come? Yeah, Vidura. He spoke some code by which they could understand. Yeah. What?
Is it going on the family?
You mean as a pastime? Yeah. Different planets. Okay.
Yes. Why not? My children. So, a 10 class young man, how to kill this boy? The first attempt was to administer poison. The Dhritarashtra constructed a house of cell land. So they are transparent. My dear boys, for some days you can live in that house. That is very nice. But Vidur gave him hint, so that you are being sent there, be careful for being killed. The house will be set fire. So Vidur was very favorable to the Pandavas. So they made a survey in that house, and when the house was set fire, they escaped through the subway. In this way, it is said, Vishan Mahagne.
Okay, turn it on. That's like a recap what we heard yesterday. So, when they came out of the subway, there's a picture of it, a DBT painting of the house burning, and they're coming out of the tunnel. And what you see is Bhima has the two cousins, Nakula, Sahadev, in his arms. And the mother is coming out, and another brother, and another brother. So they had to escape because the other brothers, they were trying to kill them one way after another. And they had more, at that time, they had more power of the kingdom by the king favoring them. So they were trying to run away now, but they were very tired. They ran for a while, and then they got very tired. But they had to keep running. So Bhima picked them all up. He took his mother on his shoulders. He took the two cousins on his two sides. And he took the two grown brothers on his arms, Arjuna and Yudhisthira. And he ran and ran, breaking branches and trees and brush underneath until they got to a designated spot where they met a boat and a boatman, which was set up by Yudhisthira. And Mahabharata says, powered by engines and sails, that boat took them farther south and let them out off on land and again into a dense forest. And they were very distressed to have to put up with all of this. But Bhima again picked them up, and he leaped high in the air and leaped through trees and knocked down anything in their way. And this way they ran through the forest until they came to a big banyan tree. And he was exhausted and lay under the tree, and his mother wanted water. So, and she was feeling very upset. They had to lie on the bare ground. So Bhima said, "You all rest, I will guard you." And he said, "Oh, look at my mother. She's so delicate, a queen. She has to lie on the bare ground. This hurts me so much, and to see my prince brothers lying like this. If I could only see those Kauravas now, I would kill them." But he stayed awake and was guarding them. So then nearby was a Rakshasa, and he smelled their human flesh. So he wanted to kill them, to eat them. And his name was Hidimba. So he sent his sister to go do the job, to kill them. Her name was Hidimba. And as she got closer, she fell in love with Bhima, who was standing there looking so powerful and beautiful. So she changed her form, which the Rakshasas can do, into from a horrible-looking creature with fangs and ugly colors to a beautiful goddess, human goddess. And she approached him, and she told him the great danger they were in, that her brother was going to come and kill them, that she could save them if they went with her. And Bhima said, "I'm not afraid of anything. Your brother can come. I can kill him." She said, "Well, I've heard humans boast like that before, but he's very powerful, and please come to safety." He said, "No, I don't want to wake up my mother and brothers. You can stay here or not stay here as you like, but I have nothing to be afraid of." Then the brother, he was getting impatient that his sister was taking so long to kill them. Then when he got there, he saw she wasn't even killing them, but she was in love with Bhima. So he was very angry, and there was a big fight. And Bhima finished him off, broke his back, and his brothers were very happy, and they embraced him. So then there's a little romantic episode where Hidimba and Bhima consummate a feeling of romance. And Yudhisthira notices that her glances are not going on Bhima without effect, that he also likes her. But they make some agreement that they can go together just until they have a child, and then he has to return to his brothers. So all this happens very quickly, that she takes him to upper regions, and they see wonderful things, and then they come back. And they have this child who's a very powerful Rakshasa, very favorable to Bhima, and he says, any time you need me, I will come. And later, in the thick of the war, he's called upon to do great heroic feats. He really helps in the turning point of the war. So then, very soon, though, the unit is get together again, the four children, and the four Pandavas and their mother, and walking and walking, and they take a camp, and Vyasadeva appears to them and speaks of how he's very favorable to them, and he directs them now that just ahead there's a village called Ekachakra, and you can take shelter there. You're definitely, nobody knows you're alive on earth, and if you go to that village, you can take shelter for a while. Don't worry, eventually you'll become the kings of the earth. He doesn't say how all this will come about, but he assures them that fate is on their side. So they go into this village, which is very pleasantly situated, and they go into a Brahmin's house where he directs them, and they're given two rooms to stay there. And they live very humbly. Every day they go out and beg alms and live in that place. We almost used up our Mahabharata time. I'll just get it to the end of this one story. So every day they go out and beg alms, but Mother Kunti stays home, and one of the boys guards her. So one day, Bhima's staying home with her, and she overhears the family lamenting. The father's lamenting, the mother's lamenting, and I think it's a grown-up daughter. There's even a little baby. So she thinks, oh, this is our chance to help this family who's giving us so much shelter. Let me find out what's wrong. So she sneaks in the next room and listens, and they're lamenting that the father says, oh, this tragedy has happened, but I'll be the one to accept the tragedy. None of you should consider that you have to give your lives. I will take my life. I will give my life. No, the mother says, if you give up your life, then how will the rest of the family live? You should live. I will go to death, accept death. And then the young boy says, no, I'm more dispensable. They're all crying and weeping. And then, sort of as a little comic relief, the little boy says, oh, don't worry. And he picks up a straw. He says, I will go and kill the demon. But then Kunti understands what's going on, and a little bit, and she enters in the company and says, what exactly is wrong? So they say, in this town nearby, there's a great demon. His name is Baka, Rakshasa. And he's got an arrangement that every day the population of the village, they have to sacrifice one person plus a big cart of food, and he will eat all that. Otherwise, he'll just ravage the whole place. So they have nothing to do but surrender to that. And it's not so often that it becomes some family's turn. But today is this family's turn. So that's why they're in grief. Well, Mother Kunti says, well, don't worry. Our family knows secret mantras whereby these demons can be killed. She doesn't want to reveal who they really are and who her powerful sons are. But by these mantras, we'll be able to kill that demon. And they're very happy to hear that. Then Mother Kunti goes back to her room and she tells Bhima, and he gets real happy and he gets looking forward to this. But when the other brothers come back, they see this gleam in Bhima's eye, And you say, what's up? See the way Bhima looks like he's ready for a good time. So Mother Kunti tells, and the other boys say, oh, this was not good. Why did you do this without talking with us? This is very dangerous. And Mother Kunti says, no, it's not dangerous. We know that Bhima can take care of this baka. Yes, I guess you're right, Yudhisthira says. There's nothing to fear. So the next day, early in the morning, Bhima loads up the cart, all food, and he starts to the place of this baka. And baka hears him coming, and he's yelling out his own name, baka, and as Bhima approaches, that Bhima gets right in front of him, and he becomes very interested in the food, and he decides, I'll eat the food first, and then I'll kill this demon. So I'll read that. The Rakshasa heard Bhima's approach. He became inflamed with anger. He ran toward the Pandava, yelling, I am Baka. Bhima saw him emerge from the trees. The earth resounded with his footsteps, and his shouts were deafening. He had a huge body, red eyes, red beard, and red hair. His mouth opened from one ear, from ear to ear, and his forehead was furrowed into three lines as he looked upon Bhima eating his food. Baka stopped near the cart and thundered, who is this fool who desires to be dispatched at once to death's abode by eating in my presence the food intended for me? Bhima glanced derisively at the Rakshasa and smiled. He ignored his challenge and continued eating. Shouldn't disturb a man while he's eating. But imagine being disturbed like that and being able to continue your composure. Baka roared in fury. He rushed at Bhima with his arms upraised. Still the Pandava continued to eat. Baka brought his two fists down upon Bhima's back with the force of a thunderbolt. Without flinching, Bhima went on eating. Didn't even cough. He did not even look at the Rakshasa. Baka roared again and tore up a huge tree. As he whirled it above his head, Bhima stood up and washed his hands from the pitcher of water on the cart. Wonderful Vedic detail that he wasn't going to engage in any fighting or finish his eating until he washed his hands. And then they have another great battle, and he's killed. As soon as he's killed, all the other Rakshasas around there run out. And Bhima, they look with horror at the mountainous form lying in a pool of blood. Bhima reassures the terrified Rakshasas that he's not going to attack them. This one has been killed due to his excessive fondness for human flesh. Give up killing men, otherwise this fate awaits you all. The Rakshasas immediately assented, saying, it shall be so. So they were afraid, and so they agreed. When I heard Hridayananda Maharaj reading this, how all the rest of the Rakshasas assented to being well behaved, he said, so that town became the only town where you could see Rakshasas in the shopping malls, he said. And there were allowable into the population because everybody knew they weren't going to attack. Well, that's our time. Any questions or comments? Yeah.
I was just in India. I was in a place called Manali, and there's one Hidimba temple in Manali. There's also a Manu, Bashish, and Bhrigu temples in this very small area.
A temple to the Lady Hidimba, or? Oh.
And they have a big festival there every year. Oh. Huge big festival.
Yeah. They have a murti?
There are, but it's very dark inside. You can't really see very much, you know?
Yeah.
Well, at least whenever I've been there a couple of times, and I've sat in there, and I've, tried to meditate as best as I could, but it's usually very quiet, and there's this huge boulders inside, like sort of rock formations, and there's a small alcove with the deity inside. You can't see very much. I suppose at festival times you'll have lights and ghee lamps to be able to see.
Yeah. We won't get so far, probably, but in the battle, her son, in English it's called Pothead, because he's bald. Something with a B. Oh, with a G. Yeah. So he's so powerful that he's slaying all the different Dhritarashtra people, and Karna has one weapon that was given to him by Indra, is invincible, but it can only be used once. Not Indra, but it's invincible. It can only be used once. So Pothead is giving everybody. It's killing everybody left and right, and it's getting to night. So they say to Karna, use it, we must use this one weapon. So he does, he throws it at him, and he dies. So, again, in the film, they went all out on their special effects for this fight of how this demon was harassing the Kauravas. And then he's finally killed. So all the soldiers on the Pandava side are all lamenting that he's dead. But Krishna says, Krishna's dancing, he's real happy. He said, why are you so happy? He said, we have killed Karna, because Karna's invincibility is finished. So he has actually killed Karna by accepting this weapon that killed him. Oh, yeah. 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 Good. So let's move on. We'll chant around now. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Now the Vrindavan section. So the way we were doing this is I would read something about Vrindavan and then ask assembled devotees to say something. It can either be a personal anecdote of experience in Vrindavan or something you know in the Shastras about Vrindavan, that sort of thing. And we can sort of churn Vrindavan Katha. I want to start in low gear. about the advantage of being in Vrindavan, just from a writer's point of view, that because a writer should write from his senses, what he sees from his senses, and in Vrindavan it's like a constant feast for writing, because you always know that in addition to what you see, there's the fact that it is the Dham, and even if you can't write something where you're, quote, seeing Krishna, unquote, you know that that's there. And it's just so exotic. The place is so exotic. So this is just following the discipline of writing, and in this amazing place. I saw a hog yesterday rummaging with his pink snout along the ground. That was somewhere while we traveled around Govardhan. We stopped in a village to get bananas. Three young school children stood together on the road. They seemed dazed by the sights, sounds, and odors around them. Near our van, a man walked on foot and slightly touched another man on his motor scooter. The touch was enough to make the man lose his balance, and his wife and baby fell off the back of the motor scooter onto the road. The young husband spoke angrily to the man who had touched them, but that man strongly defended himself. A crowd gathered. We watched, waiting for our godbrother to return with the bananas. The three dazed school kids also looked on, and a man shooed flies from the jalebis he was selling. At the place where they bathe Govardhan with milk all day long, the milk constantly runs down into the gutter. The dogs are fat with it. The sour milk smell thickens the air, but the priest smiles sweetly and accepts the offerings to Govardhan while conferring blessings. So you see there are sours and sweets and all manner of things going on. People who are very passionate, and people who are just waving their jalebis, waving the flies off the jalebis. And so many things going on. Now I'll try to become a little more spiritual. It is only by the mercy of the Supreme Lord and his associates that we can gain entrance into Vrindavan Dham. Even to stand nibbling a banana in a nearby village is glorious in terms of the varieties of births available in the cosmos. But we want to enter in earnest. We have to be patient, I know, but we should make real endeavors too. Don't make offenses. Stay here for a few weeks, absorb the mood of the Dham, then go back a changed person. I keep reminding myself that I might not be able to return here. This could be my last visit. I walk the dirt lanes with this in mind. Where is Bhagatji, Srila Prabhupada's old friend of Sakya Ras inclination now? Where are so many? They have gone to join Lord Gauranga, the great dancer. We will go too, but we must work hard for that visa. It will be stamped in the passport of pure devotional service. Even if I lack that passport, I can continue thinking of Vrindavan. Being here helps immensely. Imbibe it. Don't waste time. Bow down to the sacred earth. Don't be concerned with what others think. That soft, enchanting sand is waiting to embrace me. Yesterday I read first something about Radhakund, and then that kind of prompted the devotees, and they started talking about their experience at Radhakund at the midnight bathing. So, Rairam, could you get anything you'd like to? Do you feel any springboard from anything that I was saying?
I don't feel any special, you know, than anybody else here to speak about Vrindavan. Vrindavan is the place of pure devotional service, so kind of the realization I get from spending a lot of time there is that it's the epitome of the place of devotional service, but the practice of pure devotional service is not different from Vrindavan, or Vrindavan is not different from the practice of pure devotional service. And I think for myself, when I'm on a lower practicing stage, that it's helpful to be in the actual Vrindavan, but at the same time, because it's a lot of things that are kind of intense and even nerve-wracking, it's nice to seek a place anywhere where your nerves aren't racked.
Yeah, I was going to ask you in the last letter you wrote to me. You were in Vrindavan, and in so many ways, saying how you were relishing it, but then you said Vrindavan gets intense sometimes, and I want to go back to, quote, my country, and then you meant for Sankirtan and so on. I think I know what you mean, but what do you mean that it gets intense so that you'd want to leave
Vrindavan.
Oh. ISKCON Vrindavan gets kind of intense, as we all know. And you have to wear earplugs a lot. Sometimes. The roads, you don't have a sidewalk, you're walking on the road with every other thing that's moving at various speeds. And the change in the seasons.
Hmm.
I know, like after the 3.5-4 months of the cold weather, that it's kind of really hard on your, you know, your body, because you're always kind of tense to, you know, keep yourself from being cold and everything. And then it gets really, really hot. You know, it's an experience to stay there in May and June. But you really have to be like thinking this is like divine austerity. You know, like Radharani is sweating in the kitchen when she's cooking for Krishna. You know, so you're constantly perspiring in May and June. You know, and if you're living around this ISKCON Vrindavan, you really have to kind of be in the mood of a preacher of sorts, because it's constantly, pilgrims are coming, and like one wave after the other, one festival, one season, and you know, it's always very, a lot of people there. So if you're in the mood of like in the kirtan, you, I think, you know, it's like that, in a sense, you're like performing, especially they like to see Westerners there, you know, many Indian people, they all gather around the kirtan party, and, you know, so by performing Harinam Sankirtan there, it's a big preaching, and I guess I've kind of ended up spending a lot of time there because, you know, I have, you know, service, and I have friends there, and it's kind of a nice place to do devotional service for them. I think if anyone's going to stay there, they would have to have some type of, you know, bona fide progressive devotional service that, because after a while, without that, it would be.
I wrote in here about coming a few weeks and returning a changed person. I correspond with a lot of devotees, mostly my disciples, and it seems to be very meaningful for them to do that, you know, to go again to Vrindavan and just to stay maybe a brief period. One last devotee who wrote to me, she went with her husband and her 3-year-old child. She said, you know, how am I going to do this with a 3-year-old child? And so she deliberately didn't try to go as an ascetic, but took advantage of amenities and the MVT and so on. She said, this is the only way I could do it. She said, I was like a tourist, but just to be in Vrindavan, and I felt so changed, and I felt, and then they did all these wonderful things. They went to Radhakund and swept some area as seva every day, and then just got into it as much as they could, but within their limits. And then did go back feeling they were changed. Somebody else went there, and they went right away to the Prabhupada Samadhi and started praying, Prabhupada, what do you want me to do? You know, I'll do whatever you want me to do. And also stayed there about 3 weeks or a month or something like that. And went back saying there, felt changed. And that change maybe eventually starts to diminish. And then again they start thinking maybe we can go to Vrindavan again. So it serves that function for those who aren't residing in Vrindavan. You said about Vrindavan and preaching, aside from, I was thinking of Brihastas, those two examples I gave, but aside from that, it seems like devotees who are preachers outside Vrindavan, when they go to Vrindavan, it's not so much to preach, they just think, I want to get a break. Yeah, take a month and just do reading and chanting in the Govardhan Palace or in some place or other.
But if you like, the Krishna Bhava Mandir is a wonderful facility. You could just stay in the temple and just talk to people.
Yeah.
Many Western people coming now because, you know, they've really pumped it up on the tourist bureau, Vrindavan. You'll even see that they've erected in many, many different places these big kind of stone tablets. They're written in Hindi, but explaining what each place is. And, you know, last year in particular, there's so many groups of Western people, Americans, European people being brought to the temple, and you know, if you'd like to speak to people just one to one, if you like, just being in the temple. And
yeah.
And that's kind of nice because a lot of times Western people, they're coming for the first time, they look a little dazed and confused, and if you just come up to them and go, hey, how are you doing? Where are you from? Oh, really? I'm from this and that. And be friendly to them, and, and they get a nice experience.
Yeah.
And Prabhupada called the Vrindavan Yatra a lazy man's preaching project. And preaching means you have to go out and you have to travel, but if just by sitting tightly in Vrindavan, the whole world comes to you.
Mm.
And it's also very qualitative because people coming to Vrindavan, they know it's a holy place and it's special, so they're on their best behavior and they have high expectations of, you know, experiencing something nice. So you can, you know, just really preach from your heart and you don't have to like calculate it or covering anything. You just
I didn't know so many Western people are coming in. Yeah. Yeah.
One day when I was here, it was November, I took off 500 Westerners, Europeans, Germans, Germans, also French people. And they didn't even know about spiritual life. And I remember when they asked my age, I was sitting in a temple room after Srila Bhagavatam class because my son fell asleep during the class or was stuck. Yes. And I began to speak with some of them. And they just asked my age, so I said, I'm 46. Oh, 46. So yeah, when you're a vegetarian, you know, you're younger. I'm going to try being a vegetarian. It's so funny. They didn't know anything. Well, yes. We had a very nice folder in the Krishna section, but they were not really looking back to me. They were visiting many, many places, including Agra.
Agra, Taj Mahal?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're right next to that, so.
Yeah. They stop there and
they all go to Agra. So, you know, it's like 2/3 of the way from Delhi to there, so, you know, they just bring them through to Vrindavan and show them the things.
Just a few miles off the main road, isn't it?
Yeah,
so
5 kilometers.
And on the main road, you see big signs with a shaman and mentoring.
Yeah, like green, you know, like green highway signs.
Yeah, that nowhere else in the world can you see that. I
was trying to put Sean in the room. I turned off Vrindavan, they have like a big hand pointing for Vrindavan.
Then there's a talk about how much it's changed. And somebody said, no, it hasn't changed that much. Last time I was there was 1997. There's some different factors why I haven't gone again, and I'm trying to go soon. But I keep hearing this, even in that time, you know, oh, it's changed so much. Somebody laughs and says that it's like Manhattan now. And they say, oh, you have to go to Govardhan Palace because there you can smell the, you know, the dung fires. It's just a little village. Vrindavan, it's finished now. And then another person went and said, I heard all this talk about it's changed. It hasn't changed that much. There are a few more Tropicana flavors, and some of the sari shops accept credit cards, but it's the same thing. I mean, compared to the West, it's pretty much the same Vrindavan. Oh no, it's completely different. So you just have to go for yourself and taste what you think is different or not different. You know. And then you were talking about the temple, and you've written to me about some of the difficulties in the temple. Men, women divisions, and other things like that, and
Oh, I've heard how people go there looking for husbands and wives, that kind of thing. So, when I heard about that, somebody told me, you should avoid Krishna Balaram because this is going on like this is going on. And I thought, well, maybe it's my duty to go there, and because that's Prabhupada's temple, and maybe you could pitch in a little towards turning that tide if you wanted to do something in Vrindavan, rather than go to Vrindavan and not go there, just because that's going on. That I know that's your attitude. You're saying that this is Prabhupada's temple, and maintaining and raising the standards is desperately needed here. Somebody has to keep the temple going nicely, rather than run out somewhere. Someone, sannyasi, told me, he said, the kind of devotees who are interested in gossip and everything like that, they go to Krishna Balaram Mandir, controversy and gossip. But I mean, that shouldn't be a conclusion and say, is that so? Let's not go there then. Prabhupada Samadhi, Prabhupada's room, Prabhupada's deity. Yeah?
I found it actually quite I was thinking that when I was there, and because it's so intense and all this stuff, sannyasis and gurus avoiding the temple, and I completely understand it makes sense, but at the same time, I was thinking, the devotees need extra spiritual strength, otherwise. Especially
if they stay like this and remaining
dedicated, because otherwise the devotees go everywhere else for the nectar and all that.
Yeah.
That makes
it a little
hard. Yes, Prabhu. Well, I went recently, I spent 3 weeks, and before I went, I wrote to Jayavaita Swami and asked him some advice, and he said, avoid bad association. I'm pretty bad association myself so far. I went and I had a fantastic time. It was really absolutely brilliant, and so many things seemed to fall into place, and I came to meet all the right people at the right time, and the deities there are just absolutely superb, and I've been going to Vrindavan, I joined 18 years ago, and I've been going a lot, and I didn't find anything except it was just superb.
Some kind of sayings like, if you look for bad things, you'll find them. We just got a few minutes, and we have another feature, which is Prabhupada meditations. So let me read one and make some comment on it. Okay. I also invited you to look at the Prabhupada meditations that you might find here, and ask me to comment on one. Oh, I have volume 2 here, and which I meant to take, but as well as number 1, but now it looks like I didn't bring number 1. Well, the one I wanted to read from, I can kind of paraphrase. It's called Sugar Doll. And that refers to something Prabhupada said, as how his books can be approached from any side, just like a sweet ball, or calls it a sugar doll. He used to sit in his garden in Los Angeles and with some devotees in the evening, and he would ask that the Krishna book be read. And each night he'd just say, I said, what part should we read? He said, just open anywhere. It's a sugar doll. And he would listen a certain amount of time, not say too much. and then maybe talk a little and then go inside. Another example of that is one time Prabhupada met with some of his top book distributors, Triparari and others, and they had like a special darshan. And they had questions specifically about that service. So one of the questions was, it was like a real opportunity to hear direct from Prabhupada. Prabhupada, what books do you most want us to distribute? What do you think are the best books for the people, most accessible? So I forget starting in what order, but he said the Bhagavad Gita is very important. So then they started suggesting, what about Isopanishad, Prabhupada? Oh yes, that's very good. Mm-hmm. And then they got to more unlikely books. What about individual volumes of the Srimad Bhagavatam? Yes, that is good. They said, yeah, Prabhupada, they really like the Paranjana stories. Yes, the Paranjana stories are very good. And Chaitanya Charitamrita, nothing got excluded. So it was like they were looking for an exclusive list of best books to distribute, but they wound up with Prabhupada on hearing the name of each of his books, thinking they would be very good for people to receive. So in one sense, they didn't get the information they wanted. And then at that time also, he spoke of the sugar doll. And they even then started giving examples of people who had gotten books in odd and sequence, who had come back and said, this is very interesting, this story about such and such, which occurred in some unusual part or some out of order part of the Bhagavatam. So I was thinking like that. And Prabhupada meditations, Prabhupada's activities and so forth can be approached at any stage in his life. And that was kind of the mood of the Vyas Pujam, which is each person spoke definitely from a different point of view, not all saying the same thing. A bouquet or panorama of appreciation. And we should let them do it, not say, oh no, that's not right, that kind of thing, we don't want to hear that, and you're not qualified. But anyone who has something good to say should be heard from. Not good to say, but anyone who wants to come up and praise and serve is good. Anyone want to comment about how they think of Prabhupada as they serve or how they appreciate him?
I've grown to go proud of what he's done, and should I place importance on
it? Yeah, I think so, especially when it really feels like Prabhupada strongly, and not like a little bit of Prabhupada and a mixture of an ordinary person or something like that. When it really feels like Prabhupada, not in an absolute way, like something you would read in the purport, but I can't rule it out, because when I get a sweet Prabhupada dream, it means a lot to me, and I think about it for some time. I had a dream recently in which Prabhupada was approving me, and it still does feel so good. So where they come from, some psychologist could say, oh, that's just from your unconscious, that's what you want to feel, so it comes, whatever, when it is Prabhupada and he's improving me, I like it. And of course, when he's reprimanding you, you have to deal with that too in some way. I take them as important. I try to almost collect them, and just glad that they come and look at them without so much making a judgment on them. Instead of a nonsense scenario, I had a dream of Prabhupada.
One dream.
Bhagavata, you have something to say?
Oh, it's just that how you think of Prabhupada. I have a mental image coming into my mind of Prabhupada in samadhi. Because it's bigger than myself. Right.
Yeah.
And I often think it's the image brings me back to the feeling.
Very awe-inspiring kind of
keep
your mouth. Can you speak a little louder?
2 months ago, I think it was across the street and wrote to that the real deal. And I found myself feeling very close to Prabhupada because I had to study his books in a way, extensive philosophy in a way that I hadn't kind of done that before. And remember, like doing these classes, and it's been a non-devotional atmosphere, and it's just me, and I wouldn't go in as a devotee, but I felt I've been thinking a lot about Prabhupada and how he was preaching in the beginning days in America. And just the people that I'm meeting and that were asking me the questions, I felt it really made me enter a lot of the more deeply, more real.
Yeah, when you do intimate service, and you have a better chance of feeling his presence. So I better end now. Thank you.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.